Okay, well, good evening, and thank you for joining me. Yosef called me a few weeks ago, and he asked me whether I would give this talk, which I had given some years ago to scholar in residence, and he had heard. And I said, okay, let me see if I have notes. So fortunately, I do. And so I think I could recreate it. There are source sheets here, and I did not carefully review them, so please excuse any errors. So, usually when I speak here, I give a Dvar Halacha. Now, I'm not really that accustomed to speaking to this group in the areas of Tanakh. So, but I find in reality, you know, there's really an enormous demand for this, and that you know, I really would be, if I could pursue my personal preferences, I would really only be learning with my harusas, and I'd only be, you know, teaching, you know, Gemara and Halacha. That's not what people want. So I think that with Torah, you have to take into account Masha Libo Chafes. And it's important that we also address areas in Tanakh. But furthermore, look, you know, Tanakh provides us with the fundamentals of the Torah's Hashkafa. What is, you know, our concept of how we should live, and what's the description of an other Mishalim? So it's an invaluable asset that we have in Tanakh. And I think that people realize that, and they're eager and they're anxious to learn more about what the Torah has to say to us about the fundamentals of what does it mean to be another Mishalim, and what's the proper Derech HaChayim. And it is important that we try to respond to that, we do our best to respond to that, and we open, give people insight from what we can find in Tanakh. One of the issues that you know, I've been teaching high school for, I don't know, a long time. So I have some students here today that were my students probably close to 40 years ago. Okay, I shouldn't have said that, I'm sorry. Okay, but anyway, I was talking about Moshe. Okay, but anyway, one of the things that when you're teaching Sefer Bereishis, which I actually try to avoid, so, you know, one of the things that students are always bothered by is this treatment or the interaction, the relationship between Yaakov, between Yitzchak and Esav. How is it possible that Esav was able to deceive his father to such an enormous extent? And so I'd like to explore that today, tonight a little bit, but I want to get beyond just what Yitzchak's understanding. I want to understand how Yitzchak perceived Esav, but I also want to try to delve even further, a little deeper as to why, what made him perceive him that way. Okay. But let's start off with the issue of how he perceived him. What was his understanding of Esav? So, you know, I want to say that this shiur, although, you know, I developed it, is really inspired by a shiur I heard in probably around 1974 from my Rosh Hashiva. So there is a kernel here that comes from that, and I don't want to attribute it to him because it's really, you know, but anyway, the kernel, the inspiration really comes from an insight that he developed those few years ago. So anyway, I think that there's, you know, how successful was Esav actually in deceiving his father? So if we study carefully what took place when Yitzchak was delivering the brachas to who we thought was Esav, and then ultimately to Esav and to Yaakov, what we will uncover is that he was not completely taken in by Esav, that he was not devoid of any understanding of who Esav was. So let's take a look at some of the psukim, and that will emerge. So in source one, we see the pasuk where Esav, you know, discovers that that Yaakov has succeeded in securing these brachas that Esav had hoped that he would receive for himself. So he says, "Vayomer ki kara shemo Yaakov Yaakveini zeh pa'amayim." It's birchasi lakach v'inei atah lakach es birchas lakach birchas inei b'chorasi lakach. Excuse me, v'inei atah lakach birchasi. Vayomer, hello atzalta li bracha. So he says, you know, Yaakov, this is the second time he got me. You know, first he managed to get my birthright, and now he's got my bracha. Didn't you save a bracha for me? Now, why did Esav assume that his father had some bracha left to yet give? So the Sforno explains that Esav reasoned this out. Hello, it's out li bracha. Ava bishe chashavte levachinu bebracha el yona. V'lachshov shiye bedatcha. Ein lachshov shaya bedatcha. Shiye li hevel. V'yishar achi. Shiye lecho, excuse me. V'yishar achi shulel varum mikol bracha. So he said that, you know, I know, this is what Esav was thinking, I know you planned, your plan was to give me the best of the brachas. You were going to give me the best because I'm the Bechor. But I'm sure that you must have had something in mind to give to Yaakov. You weren't going to leave him without anything. So Esav figured, look, my brother came, he pretended he was me, he got the brachos that were intended for me. But certainly, okay, now I'm in his place. Right? He got the brachos I was intended to have, now I'm in his place. Well, there must have been something that Yitzchak planned to give to Yaakov, and so Esav is saying, why can't I have that? Let me have that. Well, Esav was sort of right. Okay? It's interesting, Yitzchak responds to Esav initially, he has nothing to give him. Ultimately, he gives him a bracha of sorts. But in reality, there was a very significant bracha that Yitzchak, so to speak, still had up his sleeve, okay, which he had not distributed. And that bracha is not given until later on in the Chumash, just a little bit later, when Yitzchak sends Yaakov off to Paddan Aram. So what happens is Yitzchak says in source 3, Kum lech Paddan Aram, beisabistu el avi imecha, v'kach li misham isha, v'kach lecha misham, isha mibenos lavan, achi imecha. V'kel shekayif arecha scha, v'yafrecha v'yarbecha, v'ayis l'kawami. Now listen, so up till now he said, look, go to Paddan Aram, get yourself a wife, right? And the Kodesh Baruch Hu, he should cause you to be fruitful, to multiply, right, and become into a great nation. And then he says, Vayiten lecha es birkas Avraham, lecha ulezarecha itcham, lirishta es eretz megurecha, asher nasan Elokim l'Avraham. But birkas Avraham, I'm giving that to you now. So all the brachos to the Kodesh Baruch Hu gave to Avraham Avinu, okay, that bracha of Yerusha Sa'aretz, and that you're going to be the nation that will represent the progeny of Avraham, that bracha is yours. So it's clear that Esav did not, if you think about what's happening over here, let's summarize. So Esav is right. There was a bracha that was being preserved yet for Yaakov, but not what Esav thought. The bracha that was being preserved for Yaakov was Birkas Avraham, that he should inherit, that Yaakov's descendants should possess Eretz Israel, and that they should be the Am that carries on the mission of Avraham and Yitzchak. So that was always in Yaakov, in Yitzchak's mind, that the bracha that belonged to Yaakov Avinu. Okay, so with this, we see the following. If things had gone the way Yitzhak actually intended, so how would it have played out? How would things have happened? Who would have gotten what? So all of the material brachas that Yitzchak ended up giving to Yaakov, thinking it was Esav, they would have gone to Esav. But Birkas Avram would have gone to Yaakov Avinu. So that's the way Yitzchak planned it. So in fact, was he completely deceived by Esav? Was he completely fooled?
No.
No. He knew that he was not the proper recipient for Birkas Avram. He never intended to give it to him. But what he did intend to do is he intended to bestow upon him these material brachos, these brachos of success and prosperity within the material world. Now, the Sforno goes on and explains exactly, more precisely, the model that or the dynamic that Yitzhak was trying to establish. So if you take a look at... let's just skip down to source number six. Okay? So we'll see in this Sforno the model that Yitzhak was trying to put in place. And it's going to be a very familiar model. You're going to recognize it right away. Have gevir la'achicha. Ki chashav, because Yitzhak was thinking. She had told Yaakov that would be best, would be good for Yaakov, to sapiklo nachlas eretz Yisrael, that he should be provided with the possession of the land of Israel, v'sheyichye ba'im eze shibud, and that he should live there under some degree of another authority, of subjugation. Kidei, why? Shelo yitron nafsho me'od b'inyanei hagashmiyim, so that his soul, his person, should not be burdened, right, with dealing with material issues, the heavenly and the southern and the physical world, the emptiness of the physical world. V'shiyat tov lo shiyat meshubad tachas achiv v'chuli, and it'd be better for him to be under the authority of his brother. In other words, what he's saying is he envisioned a relationship, a partnership between Esav and between Yaakov. That sound familiar? What does that partnership sound like?
Sound friends.
Yisachar and Zvulun. I mean, let's face it. Running a country is hard work. If you don't think so, look at how messed up this country is. But the point is it's hard work. Okay, it's not easy to run the country. As great as this country is, there's so many things that need fixing. We just can't manage to find a way to fix them in a wonderful country like this. So I'm not being critical. I'm saying even in a wonderful country, how difficult it is to make everything work. How much time, how much trouble, how much effort it takes to implement a political, economic, social system, a legal system that's going to really to maintain all the infrastructure, everything you need for a functioning political entity. Why should Yaakov be bothered? Yaakov will be in the base of Medrash. You know, be worrying about all this stuff. Esav, he'll worry about it. So from this we gain. So now we understand what Yitzchak was thinking, but we also gain insight into how he saw Esav, how he understood him. He thought Esav is a good guy. He's a good guy. He's not the kind of guy that sits in the base of Medrash. That's for sure. Okay? He's not going to be in yeshiva. But he has a good heart. He has an appreciation for the truth. He has an appreciation for Kadosh Baruch Hu, for Torah values. And so he'll be happy, you know, to be a benevolent caretaker for his brother Yaakov. and know that through doing that, he is supporting a worthy cause. And so in his mind, he had a perfect system worked out. Esav, who really is very much attached to the material world, and that's where he lives, and that's where he exists, he'll be able to do his thing, do what he does best. He'll be successful because that's where he has his energy and that's what he really understands. And he will take that burden off of his brother's back, and his brother will be free to pursue, you know, these more important spiritual objectives, the more important spiritual existence. So he wasn't completely fooled. He only made one error. He thought that Esav was basically a good guy and that he would be benevolent. That was his mistake. And he understood that Esav was not Yaakov and that he was not a spiritual creature. But he did think that he had the right values.
But that's not a small error.
No, it's not a small error. I would say it could have been a very fatal error. But I just want to contrast to, you know, that to the idea that he completely misunderstood Esav. He didn't completely misunderstand him. He did not penetrate, you know, to the nth degree into Esav's soul. Okay? So now I want to go a little bit further and understand what it was that prevented Yitzhak from seeing this. Okay, and that's how we get to Megillas Esther. Okay. So if we study Megillas Esther, we'll gain some insight into what it was that got in the way of Yitzhak being able to, like I said, penetrate into the soul of Esav and understand who this person is fundamentally. Now, Megillas Esther, you know, it's interesting when you summarize what the story of Megillas Esther is. So on the one hand, you can summarize it in different paradigms. On the one hand, you know, from a Hashgacha point of view, so it's a story of B'nai Israel being in an ace sorrow and then being redeemed from that. So from a Hashgacha point of view, that's in that paradigm, that's the story. But if you look at it, you know, from a literary point of view, it's really the story of the interaction of four personalities. And what are these four personalities doing? Pretty much manipulating Ahasuerus. Okay? So it's an account of how different individuals in the story use their understanding and their understanding of Ahasuerus and their opportunities and their positions to manipulate him to do their bidding. Okay, so I guess so from that narrative, there's a different dynamic at the same place. It's one of amazing manipulation. So Ahasuerus is the tragic. Tragic, in Shakespearean terms, he's a tragic character being manipulated by all these people around him, you know, towards whatever ends that they're out for. So, you know, Haman is the initial manipulator. So he wants to destroy B'nai Israel, and he needs to provide Ahasuerus to give him a free hand to do this. So it's interesting how he does it. Okay, so what did he do in order to persuade Ahasuerus to do something that's actually pretty amazing, to hand over to Haman an unidentified nation within his kingdom to be wiped out? How did Haman get him to do that? So if you take a look at Pasuk, at source 7, that's where the Megillah, you know, explains, where it presents Haman's argument.
Okay, so
V'lamelech ein shel v'laniham. So he describes the Bnei Yisrael as a, he doesn't identify them, but he describes them. Their name is not important. Haman does not need to tell Achashverosh the name of this nation. He needs to tell him characteristics of the nation. Who are they? What are they, I should say? They are an Am Echad, they're one nation, that is Mufuzar u'mufurad ben Amim. So they're unified and they are spread out throughout the kingdom. Throughout the kingdom. So they're among all of the different nations that are here in your kingdom. Not only are they among all of them, but their datayam shonos mikol, the mikolam that's datayam elchinamasim. And they're different. They have different practices, and they're not your practices. So the Malbim does a great job of dissecting this. This argument of Haman and explaining, how this resonated, what Achashverosh was hearing when Haman crafted this argument. So he's listening to the underlying part. He says, "Shu am mufuzar lotzi she'en lehem medina miyuchedes." So they're a dispersed nation throughout the kingdom. They don't live in one particular place. V'gam ufurad lo tzi, shigam b'midos, shoshoknim sham, lo yishaknu ba'arim pratim, rak mufuradim. And in the different states, in the different communities in which they live within your kingdom, they don't live in their own cities. Nope. They live among all the other people. Right? So it's not like this nation has their own cities, their own isolated communities. Nope. They are living among all the other people of your kingdom. So, nimtzam b'chol shchuna shchuna. They're in every neighborhood. They're in every neighborhood. V'lo b'ktzas medinas. And not just in some of the states within your kingdom. Rak b'chol amim. They're among all the nations. Asher b'chol medinos malchusecha. In all of the countries of your kingdom. Be'ofen, in such a manner, that the damage that they could do is going to impact everybody. Those Jews, he didn't say Jews, but he says those, but we know what he means. Those Jews, they're everywhere. They're everywhere, And they can influence everybody because they're spread out. They've infiltrated every element of your kingdom. And they're different. They have their own practices. They have their own ways of doing things, and they're not your ways. So what is he playing to?
Paranoia.
Insecurity. Okay. Insecurity, paranoia, insecurity. So Haman somehow knew, that Achashverosh could be seduced by appealing to his insecurity. And that if he pressed that button, he would get what he wanted. Now, we don't know exactly what Haman saw that told him that Achashverosh had an issue with insecurity. We don't know. However, when we look at the Megillah, we could see for ourselves that this insecurity, it does present itself from the very beginning. Because
Are you suggesting that Achashverosh knew that it was the Jews, or he didn't?
He didn't.
He didn't know
who No, he didn't care. It didn't matter who they were. All that mattered for Achashverosh, and this is what Haman understood, is the danger that they presented. So,
and the money.
The money didn't hurt. Yeah. So what did he? We don't know exactly how Haman figured this out, but we do see indications of Achashverosh's insecurity from the very beginning. Achashverosh is the beginning opens with this enormous celebration that Achashverosh organizes and conducts and executes, and the Megillah at length describes the extravagance of it, and it's what in the vernacular of economics it's called conspicuous consumption, okay. So in Veblen's theory of leisure class, so he talks about conspicuous consumption. This is what Achashverosh is engaged in, conspicuous consumption. Conspicuous consumption means, you know, it means the consumption, spending money, you know, buying things, not because you need them, but because you need to show that you can. You need
just
to demonstrate.
So many people to me.
Okay, well, okay.
Thank you, everyone.
Now, see, my MBA actually did some good. Okay, so anyway, so it's a practice that Achashverosh is exhibiting here. He is expending an enormous amount of time, energy, money, resources, enormous amount of time, in order to demonstrate how wealthy he is, how powerful he is. When a person needs to do that, it suggests that the person has some issues with a personal insecurity. Because who are they, you know, why do they need to give this enormous demonstration? And the Megillah, again, spends a lot of words describing the extravagances of Achashverosh's ceremony. But what's interesting is, and I think it's one of the most amazing parts of those opening portions of the Megillah, is that all those days of that longer party, Achashverosh conducted himself apparently with dignity. You know, he didn't make a fool of himself until the end. What changed? So at the end, there was a second party. And the second party was for who? First party was for the dignitaries. The second party was for who?
The people of Shushan.
For the people of Shushan. That's where Achashverosh got drunk and made a fool of himself and eliminated Vashti. Now, why is it why did he need this party? Why did he have to make a second party? You'd think he'd be exhausted after the first one. And who's he trying to impress? These are just the regular people. The answer is that the first party he made because he felt he needed to make an impression. You know how painful that was for him? To have to be surrounded by ministers who he feels he has to. Have you ever been in that situation? I mean, just think about it. I think we all have. Where we're in a situation where we have to be watching everything we do because we're with someone or a group of people that we know we have to impress. Right? I mean, you do it for an hour, for 2 hours. Can you imagine doing it day after day? Day after day? Day, week after week? Having to be on your best behavior, not being yourself, because you need to watch everything you're doing to impress the people that are around you. At the end of that period, Achashverosh is emotionally exhausted. What does he want? What does he want? What does he want?
Let his hair down.
He wants to let his hair down. He wants a party with the boys. Okay? And he did let his hair down. And that's when he got drunk and he made a fool of himself. Yeah, but that was a reaction to the same insecurity. That confronting an insecurity and having to control himself and be somebody other than he saw himself being took an enormous toll on him. So at the end, he wanted to reward himself with an opportunity, like you said, let his hair down. And that's what he did. But unfortunately, he let it down a little bit. Well, I mean, it worked out for us. But for him, he regretted it, in hindsight. He let his hair down a little bit too much. Okay. So, did Haman see all these things? Is this what, you know, gave Haman the idea that Achashverosh is insecure? We don't know. But what he saw, how he came to his understanding is not revealed. But we could see it in the story. And there's even one Chazal that is even more to the point. And if you take a look at source number 12, so this is a Medrash. So this is a Medrash. I'll read it to you. It's a Medrash from Koheles, actually, not from Megillas Esther. And okay, and in this Medrash, I'm sorry, this is not what I want. Excuse me. I want source number. Yeah, right. Source number 11. Sorry, not the Mesh. I want this Gemara in Megillah Daf Yud Beis on the Beis. Right. So what happens in this Gemara? So I have a sofa melech me'el. Okay, so he got very angry at Vashti when she refused to appear at his party. Okay, in the inappropriate, you know, state that he demanded. Okay, Amai, why did he get so angry? So Amarava, Shalchale, because she sent him a message. When he demanded that she come to his party and entertain his guests, so she sent him a response. And basically what she said to him was, that you are my father's stable master. My father, okay, he could drink you under the table and he would not be drunk. And you know, you had a little bit to drink and you're making a fool of yourself. So the point is that she was saying to him, I'm from royalty, you're not from royalty, right? And look at how you're conducting yourself. And that made him fly off the handle. What did she say to him? She says, "You're not worthy. You're just a commoner. Okay, you're just a commoner." And that made him fly off the handle, and he had to remove her. He had to remove her after that. So again, you see how she hit that button. She pressed the button of his insecurity, and he completely flipped out. And afterwards, he so much regretted it, but in that moment, because of his insecurity, which she had pressed that button, he could not control himself, and he got rid of her. Took the advice and got rid of her. So, what do we have here? So let's summarize what we have. So we started off talking about Yitzhak, and we came to understand that Yitzhak had somewhat of an understanding of Esav, but did not appreciate the depth, he couldn't penetrate into really was the bottom of it, what was really inside, what was really internal, who was he really fundamentally. On the other hand, in contrast, we see Haman had a really keen capacity to be able to appreciate what makes Ahasuerus tick, knew how to press his buttons to get what he wanted. So, I mean, my question is, and this is what I really want to get to, is how come Haman was able to penetrate Ahasuerus? I mean, I'm sure he wasn't as wise as Yitzhak, but Yitzhak couldn't figure out how Esav worked. What was it? Was it just because it was his son? I mean, what was it that gave Haman this capacity to so keenly and accurately understand Ahasuerus, but yet on the other hand, Yitzchak couldn't really see what Esav was all about. So if we go a little bit towards the end of the Megillah, so we're going to learn about Haman, okay? Well, actually, it starts earlier. Okay? It starts earlier when Haman first becomes appointed by Ahasuerus. So if you take a look at source 15, so... before I get to this, I just want to explain that, you know, Esther used the same insecurity to get... She played the same heartstrings in Ahasuerus to get what she wanted. Right? How did she get Ahasuerus to turn against Haman? So if we take a look at source 13, so Vatomer Esther Imal Amelech Tov Yavo Amelech Haman Ayom El Mishte Asher Asisilo. So Esther said, if the Melech would so favor, so he should come with Haman to the Mishte that I am making for him. So she invited Haman and the Melech to come to this dinner party. Okay, so Rashi explains in source 14. So Rabbi Seinu Amru Talmim Harbe B'davar. So our sages saw many explanations for this. Okay, Mara Esther Shizimna Es Haman. Why did she invite Haman to come with Ahasuerus? So they explain. Okay, Likan Ova Melech. So he says that You know, the most obvious reason is that she was trying to evoke in Achashverosh a sense of jealousy, a suspicion. So she invited him to the first party. At this point, Achashverosh is getting a little anxious. Why is she inviting Haman to come to this party, this dinner party with me? Why Haman? Right? And then, what does she do? This was so much fun. Let's do it again tomorrow night. And bring Haman. So, you can imagine what's going on in Achashverosh's mind when he sees this happening. What's going on? What is Haman? Does he have some kind of relationship with my queen? Is he trying to pull something off? You know, what is going on here? And then, wow, you know, a funny thing happened. He had a very troubled night. And he made an amazing discovery. That one time in the past, you know, Mordecai had saved his life. And Haman should have made sure that Mordecai was rewarded. Because, you know, I mean, isn't Haman his friend? Haman's looking out for his best interest, right? So if you're looking out for the best interests of your patron, you know, you're going to make sure that those that help your patron are rewarded for that. They get positive reinforcement. And everybody knows it, right? Well, he did nothing. How do you think Achashverosh interpreted that? So all this is, you know, coalescing. All these different factors are coming together. Haman is got something going with Esther over here and not really maybe looking out for the best interests of his patron. And, well, Achashverosh, same insecurities that Haman, you know, had used to get what he wanted are now working against him and suggesting to Achashverosh that maybe Haman can't, shouldn't, better not be too trusted. So that both Haman and Esther, you know, they both identified and used the same frailty in Achashverosh to secure their ends. But now let's move on. But why was Haman able to see this in Achashverosh? And but Yitzhak, you know, was somehow baffled when it came to Esav. So we have to understand Haman a little bit better in order to answer the question. If you look at Source 15, I think these are some of the most important psukim, you know, in Megillas Esther, just to understand, you know, both, you know, on different levels, on a couple levels, what's going on. So Haman saw that Mordecai wasn't bowing. You know, he wasn't kneeling, he wasn't bowing to him. And he got very angry. And it was, you know, unworthy of him just to deal with Mordecai. Nah, right? Because he knew Mordecai was a Jew. And so Haman decided the best thing to do, the right thing to do, the most effective thing to do is not go after Mordecai, go after the entire nation. Go after the entire nation. Now let's understand this, okay? Let's just think about this for a moment in the context that we've just developed. So Haman is the prime minister, essentially the prime minister of the country. He's in control. Everybody honors him. He's most powerful. There's this guy, Mordecai, who refuses to bow down to him. Okay, so I can understand why Haman would feel that Mordecai needs to be punished. Okay, I get that. Okay, I can see that. I mean, you got to enforce respect for, you know, respect for the prime minister. But the whole nation? The whole nation? I mean, Mordecai may be, what's the thing? You see, Mordecai's behavior may be a reflection on the value of this entire nation, so I shouldn't just destroy Mordecai, I gotta destroy all of them. What does it sound like? What does it say? Well, he's pretty insecure. He's pretty insecure. He's really insecure, right? I mean, he's got this real problem. You know, to eliminate his, and, you know, and later on, it comes out even more
emphatically. And look at source 16. This is the most amazing expression of insecurity. He leaves the party, the first party with Esther and Achashverosh. He is so happy because, you know, he's falling for it. He doesn't realize what's happening. He is so happy that Esther has shown him this favor and invited him to come to this party. It's him and Achashverosh, this exclusive gathering. And when Mordechai did it again, and he didn't kowtow to him, so Haman became overwhelmed by anger. Okay, but look what happens next. Okay, so if you skip down to Pasuk Yud Aleph, by Yisaper Lemnik, so Haman comes home, and now is what he tells his wife and his household. Okay? All the people, always friends. By Yisaper Lam Haman as Kavod Oshro, Ves Rov Banav, Ves Ko Asher Gidlo Hamelech, Ves Ko Asher Yisal Al Sarim Vavdei Hamelech. He retells, he describes all of his glory, everything he's achieved, everything that he has. Vayomer Haman, and Haman says, Af Lo evi Esther amalka im amelech el amishta asher asa ki im osi. I am the only one that Esther invited to come to this mishta with Achashverosh. Only me. V'gav l'machar ni karula im amelech. And tomorrow again I'm invited. And then he says, v'chol zeh einenu shoveli. It's worth nothing. It's meaningless to me. Okay? Every time I see that Mordechai sitting in the Shaar HaMelech and he refuses to acknowledge me. Hey, this is nuts. I mean, he tells him, he acknowledges, he tells him everything that he has, everything that he's achieved. It's beyond description. He can't even encompass it. And even special treatment from the queen herself. Worthless. Dismisses the whole thing because Mordechai won't acknowledge me. That is enormous, intense insecurity. So, Dali answers now, go back to the question. Why is it that Haman was able to identify Achashverosh's insecurity? Why? He recognized himself. He saw himself in Achashverosh. So, because he saw himself in Achashverosh, and he knew what makes him uncomfortable, what makes he himself tick, he understood, he could recognize, he could instinctively recognize in Achashverosh his insecurity, because it was a reflection of his own personality. Right? It's like the expression, ko aposo ba mumo poso. You know, we are very sensitive in seeing in others our own failings. And so Haman was able to identify it like that because it was very familiar with him. It was his companion day and night. Okay? His insecurity was with him when he sat at his table, when he was with his family, when he was walking to the palace, walking out of the palace, that insecurity was with him all the time. And so when he saw Achashverosh's behavior, he recognized those behaviors immediately. And he knew exactly what they represented. And that gave him the key for how he would manipulate Achashverosh. Esther also, you know, understood what was happening, and she used the same key. But now we could go back to our question. Okay? Why could Yitzhak not penetrate and see Esav's true soul? Why not? Because it was completely alien to him. Okay? As opposed, these are actually opposite dynamics. When you are dealing with Haman, when we deal with Haman and Achashverosh, what facilitates Haman's capacity to understand Achashverosh is his own personality, is his familiarity with his own personality. And how he feels, how he thinks, how he responds, how he instinctually reacts to different situations. And he could use that as a predictor of how Ahasuerus will react to his manipulations. Take that away, remove that, and then it becomes much more difficult to understand or appreciate how a person is going to conduct himself or what a person's really about. It is because of Yitzchak's greatness, because he was so far removed from the type of attitudes that in the depths of Esav's soul motivated him, that he could not recognize them. In other words, I'll say it another way. We understand people to a great extent because, just like Haman, we see ourselves. We can, when we see it, we have a plethora of our own, you know, feelings and emotions and instincts. So we could recognize them in other people, and we understand what they are, and sometimes it gives us empathy, sometimes it tempts us to be manipulative, but we have this tool built into our personalities. We could use it, and we do use it. Okay, and that's why you could sit down at a table with somebody and you could, you know, maybe make a connection immediately, because you have this capacity to empathize with the person based on your shared feelings, your shared attitudes, your shared, you know, emotional makeup, elements of that makeup. So that's a tremendous aid we use. We don't have to be analytic. It's instinctual. Okay? If you're dealing with a tzaddik gemor, with an upstart such shalem as Yitzchak is, so then appreciating the evil in another person becomes a strictly rational, analytical process. You have nothing else to use. And how, you know, you have to gather evidence, you have to do an investigation. Yitzchak didn't have the capacity, the emotional makeup to just see into Esav. Okay? And so in the absence of that tool that Haman had, and that we all use, Yitzchak, because of his very shlemus, because of the fact he was so elevated over, he was the Ola Tamim, he was so elevated over all of these ways of thinking and these type of more mundane and I should say, you know, the more base part of humanity. He looked at Esav and he couldn't imagine anybody could be like that. Anybody could be like Esav really was. Just unimaginable. Why would a person be like that? Why? You know, why? Why would a person be like that? It doesn't make any sense, right? It's crazy. I mean, you know, nobody would be like that. You know, so his interpretation of Esav was the interpretation that made sense to him. Nobody would be like really evil. That's crazy, right? So he must be a guy that really is a good guy. But look, you know, Nebuch, you know, we all know people like this, you know. They're not the best learners. You know, they're good people, you know. They're gonna do a lot of good in their life. They have great values. They're gonna raise a wonderful family, they're gonna be Balei Tzedakah, they're gonna be active in the community, but they're not gonna be the guys in the base of Medrash. Maybe they'll come to a shir once a week, who knows, you know, but that's about it. You know, they're not those guys, right? So that's the only way you can understand them. You know, the idea that somebody could really be corrupt, that doesn't make any sense. Who would be really corrupt? That's nuts. Yeah?
What do you say about Esther's capacity to understand Ahasuerus and his security?
I just wonder, I don't know, but I just wonder whether or not Esther had the opportunity to take advantage of Haman's insights. In other words, Esther acted after Haman did. So she had an advantage that Haman did. Haman had to figure it out. But after Haman figured it out, you know, basically Ahasuerus was revealed. You know, so you just have to wonder whether Esther had her own insight or whether she was just a good observer and understood what was taking place with Mordechai's help. I mean, he fed her a lot of information, and she just said, "Okay, well, you know, what did Haman discover? And if it worked for him, it could work for others." And then she formulated this ingenious. She had enormous. See, Esther had enormous, what we call emotional intelligence. So she knew how to construct a very compelling case for Haman being the root of all evil.
Thank you.
You're welcome. You're welcome.
Okay.